It is now time for our main speaker. Please welcome Hero from Laguna Beach, Long Beach.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Hero, and I am an alcoholic. Grateful to be here, grateful to be sober. Thank you all for asking me to come and speak. I have a sobriety date. It's November 12, 2007. And that's, so that means, today's the 13th. It's been 1 day, 8 months, and 12 years, or 17 years without a drink or a drug or anything that affects me from the neck up. And, I have a sponsor. His name is Larry J. He's been sponsoring me for a little over 4 months since my previous sponsor passed away at 64 years of sobriety, and he was 94 years old. So I loved calling and whining to that man. You know,
because he's all this dirt.
I like going, I have a home group. It's a Bellflower Big Book group. And my sponsor, Larry J, is also a good member of that group. And he's a hero whisperer. Like, he gets right underneath my ego really fast. And if you have a mind that tells you to do stuff that later on you're like, why did I do that? Then you need a sponsor that can just, that is a you whisperer, that can get right underneath your ego fast, make you able to giggle about yourself just a little bit when things are really bad. And that's so useful. Tim asked me to speak when this group first started, and so it's really nice to see a fellowship grow around this room and to see this grow like it is right now. This is beautiful. This is beautiful. Congratulations to all the chip takers, the birthdays. Welcome to those of you who are new. I hope you leave with a sponsor. I hope you leave with someone that you'll call like half an hour after the meeting so that you get in the habit of it. And I wish I could remember the name of the blues singer. There's a song that kind of describes my life right now. I'm gonna whine to you for a minute, and I'm gonna whine to my friend Mac, who's got a couple days, and I'm gonna whine to Debbie, who's like outside hugging Elijah when she first saw him and crying because she's at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's so beautiful. And there's just one blues song that my wife hates and that I adore. And the lyrics are, done got old, can't do the things I used to do. You know, and that feels like my life just a little bit, even though I'm still pretty young. But there's so many things I used to do that I can't do. And that just bothers me. And if I allow myself, I'll grind on it, you know, for like a few days or a year. And I'm grateful to have sponsorship and people in Alcoholics Anonymous that tell me, you know, well, that sounds selfish, and self-centered, certainly. Can't see beyond like my own experience, which the philosophers call phenomenology. I can't see beyond what I feel, see, smell, sense, and that's just the material world. I can't see the spiritual. There are things that would help me see beyond like this, beyond like life, beyond like when I was a kid, my family. Oh, I'm so Asian. Recently in my home group, no, seriously, recently in my home group, I started introducing myself with my whole first name. Like, I started saying, my name is Hiroshi, I'm an alcoholic. And I got rid of that name in like preschool. Like, I started calling myself Hiro then. And because I couldn't change my eyes, I couldn't change my little bowl haircut that my mom would like cut for me. I couldn't change like the little thrift shop clothes we would get because my dad was in grad school. But damn it, I can change my name. And the other thing I really wanted to change really fast was sounding. I couldn't change looking like an immigrant, but sounding like an immigrant, that I could do something about. I can learn how to sound like you. I can learn how to fit in. And that's all I ever wanted, was to fit in. And imagine my surprise at age 12 when I discovered alcohol. And it helped me just to fit in. I don't know if I looked like I fit in. I probably didn't. I probably still looked funny looking, but I felt like I fit. And that was so good. I was talking to my friend Therese, who I feel like I've known for a while now, and just discovered that that she went to like college in the South, my family moved to Tuscaloosa, Alabama at the turn of the 70s. Right, and we were the Asian family, and wasn't able to go to Vancouver a couple weeks ago, but I was able to go to the 2015 International in Atlanta, and that was something that really helped me to get rid of a lot of assumptions and prejudices I had about prejudices in the Deep South. It made me realize that when there were like 14 eyeballs in a family of seven on a porch, like staring at me and my mom and my dad and my mom pushing my little sister, who was like before one, up the hill to get to the park from the Rose Towers in Tuscaloosa, that to me felt like we were exposed. And but every time we would say hi, they would all like wave and go, hi, you know, and super friendly. But I felt like an insect. I felt observed, and maybe I was. My previous sponsor, Johnny Harris, would talk about, I am observed. If I feel observed, it's because I am. It's because people are judging me. So if you feel like you're in the room and you're being judged, you are. You are. And so what he would tell, and for me, being judged is not a comfortable feeling. I don't like being judged. I don't like going before a judge. I don't like being judged. I don't like it. And the weird thing is that my number one solution for not being judged, well, maybe it's number two until it became number one. My number one solution first was to not be around, like just to be in my room and reading or like be high up in a tree. But my favorite solution from age 12 was to just get as drunk and as high as possible. Right. And my whole idea was like, once I discovered that you can feel amazing, I just wanted to feel like that all the time. All the time, because I'm a guy. Even you know, I just turned 60 this year. I'm a guy where I don't want to feel bad. I don't want to. I just want to feel amazing. And that's just insane. Because if I'm laughing hysterically when I discover that my mom died during COVID, that's weird. And I wasn't. I was breaking down crying. Or like when my dad died a year and a half, almost to the day earlier, 2019. And because I had a different solution, because I had found a solution that helps me to have comfort most of the time and helps me be comfortable with discomfort some of the time, but enough of the time so I don't turn to a drink or a drug. And that's insane for a guy who just wants to play and not work, just wants freedom and no responsibility. And we're living in a time that where the world is scary. I mean, it was scary when I was a kid. It was scary when I was a teenager. Coming into the meeting, I met some old school punks, and that made me so happy because first alcohol and then punk rock made me feel like I belonged with a bunch of people that just don't belong. And the crazy thing about alcohol is that it made me feel I wasn't judged until it made me behave in ways that ensured that I was judged by people that I hadn't even met before. Like I they weren't even on my radar, people who judged me. And I remember what Johnny told me, like I was having a hard time a year ago, March. And I was talking about Brenda about this before the meeting. And it was the last time I was suicidal in Alcoholics Anonymous, or in life, really. But this time, it was a different kind of suicidal. This was a suicidal where it was like a kinder, gentler suicidal, where I needed to find, like for 2 days, I needed to find a way to not be here. I needed to find a way to die. I just couldn't be here. I needed to find a way to die without anyone missing me, finding me, or having to identify me. Turns out there's no way, but I spent 2 days like really trying to figure it out. And I remember Johnny telling me at the time, hey, you know what, you're the only Big Book that some people are going to see, and people are going to judge you in your home group, in Big Book group. I mean, people are going to judge you for the kind of Big Book you are. And some of them are going to judge you negatively, even if you're doing your best. They don't matter. He told me they do not matter. They matter as people to help if they come to me for help, you know. But all I could do is just let them be. And I learned in my home group that if people give me like if you're new and you get if you're new, you probably got a lot of unsolicited advice, like just in the last like hour. And whether you want it or you don't want it or it's irrelevant, just say thank you. That's it. That's the code word. Everyone in here knows that thank you means two things. It means thank you and it means F you. But it all sounds like thank you. I'm wrong. So, it tells me in the big book that in the chapter working with others in chapter 7, which outlines a 12th step, it tells me that I'm supposed to emphasize the hopelessness of our condition. I was just sitting with a newcomer just a few days ago. And he was crying at the church that we were meeting at and talking about how, like, why is it that I keep going out? Why is it that, he was so filled with shame. Like, I keep choosing to go out. And I'm like, oh my God, I know you understand the first half of the first step. I know you understand that once you take a drink of a drug, that all bets are off. You cannot predict what's going to happen. But it sounds like you don't understand the second half of the first step, which we have no power, choice, or control whether we take a drink. Now, I'm not criticizing anyone else's pitch at all. I've heard people that I respect say I chose to take a drink. Maybe that's your experience. My experience is the choice that feels like a choice isn't a choice once I realize what that drink does. The choice that feels like a choice was every time I took that first drink, I was stone cold sober. I was in my right mind. I was compost mentis. I was okay, except I was so freaking not okay. And I knew that the only way to get okay was to have that. And I didn't know or care that afterwards I would die to have that sober drink early. And what happens is in that state, I end up harming the people that I love the most. And in that state, and I know, like, in my gut, in my bowels, that if any of you treated my family and the people I love the way that I treated them, I would want to kill you. But it's me. It's me. It's me, the person I trust and loathe the most. How did I do that? How did I get here? And the answer is powerlessness, having no power, choice, or control over the first drink. That's something I didn't know until the age of 42. That's something I didn't know. I didn't know it when I was 14 and people were saying, maybe you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did what I suppose all of us did, which find other people have been drinking and use more than we can. And that way I don't have to be able to feel good about my drink and my using. I didn't know about powerlessness over the first drink, over whether I'm going to take a drink when I was suicidal at age 16 with a handful of Valium and a handful of Librium and a bottle of Bacardi 151. I didn't know I was powerless over doing that when I came to a lake of like vomit and half-dissolved pills on that shag carpet in my parents' house. And I'm grateful today that I passed out on my side so I didn't aspirate on my own vomit like my favorite rock and roll star. I didn't know it when I got kicked out of that little private preparatory school where I was a day student, where most of the people were boarding students. And I didn't know that when I came back in that I would have no power, choice, or control over whether I took a first drink. I had no idea that when I drop out of UCLA, where I got into at 18, I didn't know that I'd be dropping out of there soon thereafter because I needed to be able to drink the way I wanted to and have no consequences academically. If you drop out, you have no consequences academically. And even when I get my stuff together and I come back and I'm able to graduate from there, you know, 7 years after I started in a four-year program, and I get into a PhD program for English literature at the University of Chicago, one of the top 25 English programs. And there are people that remember me that are my wife's former colleagues. She just retired at Long Beach City College. My wife's former colleagues, there's one of them that knew me then or knew of me then. And I was being groomed to be, it's no longer a great word, but I was being trained to be a critical theorist. I was being trained to be an academic superstar. And instead, what I thought I had was seasonal affective disorder and graduate student writer's block. And what it actually was, I now know, was alcoholism, now that I've done a thorough inventory. And I look good on paper, and sometimes I can look good in person. I fill out another application. I get into the other school. I get into USC in their film, literature, and culture program, and I get a full ride there. And in order to have that full ride, I have to, I have to, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know today, sober, that all of my have-tos are get-tos. But then I thought I had to. I had to teach freshman writing. And what that meant was when bewilderingly, I had somehow not only brought graduate student writer's block, but also seasonal affective disorder from a wintry Chicago to sunny Southern California. That was bewildering. And I drop out of there, but my wife and I fall in love. She was not gonna like date anybody until she graduated, and instead we trauma bonded right during the civil unrest, which was called the LA riots at the time. It might be an outside issue, but that was one time when like seeing seven pillars of smoke go up from Los Angeles and being in the hills of Silver Lake, not being able to get to the freeway because everyone was trying to escape LA and just weeping and having like the Clash's Armageddon time playing on this little mixtape I made for her. And I'm just weeping. I'm weeping because like, how did this happen? Anarchy is not cool. I'm good at cleaning up. I'm really good at cleaning up. I'm good at stopping. I'm good at cleaning up. I don't like stopping. I like having had stopped. Stopping sucks, but having had stopped for a short time is amazing. And what do? I end up doing some odd jobs. I end up working I did a year at Children's Hospital Los Angeles Foundation as a proposal writer. And then after a year, they eliminated that position. I wasn't great at it. I was decent. I remember going back and teaching a class and I get a call from the director of development there. And she says, "Hey, I just took a job at a shelter for homeless and runaway youth in Hollywood. And I remember you hated being behind a desk, but I remember you loved meeting the kids and the doctors and the nurses. I think you do really good over here." And so I head over there and at this time I'm, you know, because I'm a functional alcoholic, except I don't think I'm an alcoholic. I just function by drinking on the weekends or after work and it works out fine, except that's how I think. That's how I, and anyway, I function until I am the dysfunction in my family. But I remember the second year there, she said, "You know, I think you'll love working in the crisis shelter. Why don't you come try it out? It pays next to nothing, but I think you'll be happy there." And I was happy there. The second year, they promote me to be be the group facilitator in the new day treatment program in the crisis shelter, and I loved that. And that was my first real introduction to you. I would drive those kids to meetings like this one in a van, like maybe one's outside right now. And weirdly, my alcoholic arm, like in formats like this one, y'all would say, like any other alcoholics in the room, my arm would shoot up. I just thought that I was the kind that, you know, that got to have a little sippy poo after I got home. My wife finishes that PhD and she goes back to her hometown where she gets her first job at Bakersfield College. And I go up there to join her after a year apart, where I'm driving up there and I know that I shouldn't drive drunk. And so I by this point, I'm an adult and I'm not driving drunk. And so I'm just getting high as F, you know? And so, and that's fun. And I, so I, so I, so I go up there and, cause I didn't know that DUIDs existed. So yep, anyway, so, and I would do that most weekends, head up there. And I finally moved up there and I took some classes to do psychology. And I end up, taking all the psychology classes at Cal State Bakersfield would offer. And I apply to some schools, take the GRE, get a perfect score on the GRE, because when I'm doing well, I look amazing. And I get into USC in their PhD program in counseling psychology, and I do all the things. I'm someone who can show up until I can't. And this time I have my longest streak. I show up to everything. I do all these trainings. I do all my classes. I do all the reading. I write most of my dissertation. I do a year-long experiment. I collect the data, and I'm in a pre-doctoral internship. And the next thing I know, I'm having a psychotic episode in the hospital in which I'm doing my internship. I'm having a psychotic episode in Children's Hospital Los Angeles, the best place someone in their 40s should be having a psychotic episode. And I don't know if any of you have been psychotic, but I was seeing things that you don't see, and I was hearing things that you don't hear, and I was actively delusional. In other words, believing things that if you saw the evidence, you would know it's not true, but I believe them. And I don't know maybe you've had this happen to you, where there's a weird thing about delusional disorder where if you try to convince a friend that they're safe, they're okay, no one's after them, then sometimes they'll like incorporate you into the delusion, like, oh, you're one of them. Like, that was me, right? And I'm trying not to be psychotic. And if you've been psychotic, you know trying really hard not to be psychotic doesn't work. It's very distressing. And I was trying not to be psychotic so I could go provide psychotherapy to a 7-year-old. And you might have never done play therapy, but it's really, really hard to do play therapy for a 7-year-old girl with generalized anxiety disorder if the therapist is more terrified than the child. And it's virtually impossible to not have terror on board if the shadows won't stop freaking moving. And I go to my boss. I don't even try to see that appointment. I go to my bosses, and I had enough of me online where I realized that would be harmful. I can't do that. And I tell them a little bit of what's going on. I'm trying to explain them. I'm just trying to get a good night's sleep. And I've been only sleeping maybe 3 or 4 hours a night, maybe 3 or 4 nights a week. And this has been going on for about 6 months. I've been driving from Long Beach all the way up to Hollywood. And sometimes I don't remember the drive. And I'm having panic attacks at work. And maybe I have that sleep deprivation psychosis. And before I had so many more symptoms to tell them. I was excited to tell them, and they wouldn't let me. They're like, no, please stop. Please don't contact your patients. We'll take care of them. Please go to HR. They'll connect you to the employee assistance program. They'll connect you to someone who can help you. Please get help. Do what they say. Come back when you're better, but please bring a note. And so I do that thing. I do that thing that I'm really, really good at for the very last time. I get off of everything. And I go back and I know it's gonna work out. I know I'm gonna be able to finish. I know that I'll be able to finish the pre-doctoral internship. I'll get the PhD, I'll get a postdoc, I'll do all the hours and get the license, and I'll do all of that. Today, I forget to say this sometimes, today I am licensed by the state of California to practice psychotherapy in the state of California. I'm not saying that to get you as a patient, I can't see you. I'm telling you that because the license to practice psychotherapy in the state of California is in my case, for doctorate, is from the Board of Psychology. The Board of Psychology, like the Board of Behavioral Science for the master's folks, is part of the Department of Consumer Affairs. And the California Department of Consumer Affairs exists for one purpose and one purpose only, to protect you from me. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, you no longer need to be protected from me. The state of California is safe for me as long as I stay active and stay honest with the sponsor and stay teachable. But I didn't know that back then. I just thought all I have to do is stay on the straight and narrow, just not drink, not use, I'll be good. And that phenomenon that I described to you, that's it's described in the Big Book as an obsession, where we're leaving aside the drink question. What happens in my mind? And what happened in my mind today on that day was, it was just like Fred. Chapter three, More About Alcoholism, has 4 case studies about people who know that they can't drink and they don't drink and then they end up drinking. What's happening in their mind? And in my mind, this is what's happening. Someone invites me to a wine tasting after work, and I think wine tasting, that's really civilized. Have those little tasters from light over to dark, and it'll be fine. And I forget all the reasons. And the crazy thing is, I go to the wine tasting, I just did the tasters, I buy a case of wine in the cellar, because alcoholics don't sell their wine, and I buy a bottle that's ready now, and I'm gonna have it the following week, because if I were an alcoholic, I'd have to drink it tonight. And I'm trying to prove to myself that I'm not an alcoholic, not even realizing that only alcoholics do that. And within a month, I'm nutty. Within a month, my wife is threatening divorce. Within a month, and we just celebrated 30 years of marriage. Thank you. And that, you're clapping for Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, that is a result of AA and good fortune. And And what happens is when she threatens divorce with those terrifying dead glass taxidermy doll eyes, and once in a while she'd be like blink blink, and it turned to terror, and blink blink, like nictitating membranes or something, like blink blink, like disgust, like blink blink horror. And I make a phone call. It's 9:30 p.m. on a Friday night. I make an SOS phone call. I don't call any of you. I know so many alcoholics that are sober and happy, joyous, and free as a result of being active members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't call you. I call the only person I can think of, and she picks up the phone on the third ring. And I'm on the phone going, Mary, I'm so glad you answered the phone. I think I'm bipolar. I think I need to live. I don't trust my doctor. I think I need to do something. And she's never heard me like this terrified and manic before. So she says the only kind of reasonable question, which is, what's going on? And I surrender and I tell her everything. Usually I'm really good at giving people parts of the truth and making sure, because if one person knew everything, then that would look really bad. And I already told you about not wanting to be judged, so that's terrifying. But I tell her everything for about 20 minutes. I just burn. It's this monologue of all the skeezy acting out I'm doing, all the crap I'm pouring into my body, not to try to get high or drunk, but just to try to get to okay. I just want to get to okay. You remember that movie? It's old now. It's like 1990. Reservoir Dogs. Remember that movie? It's a like a jewelry heist that goes wrong. And I'm not blowing the plot. That happened in the first 10 minutes. And Harvey Keitel's a getaway driver. And Tim Roth's in the back, and he's been gut shot. And he's in the back going, the Keitel character is just trying. He's just trying to drive the getaway car. And he's trying to calm down the guy in the back so he can just drive. He's like, you're not gonna die. You're gonna be okay. Say that to me, you're gonna be okay. And the guy in the back is going, I'm gonna be okay. I can't even get to that. And after I'm done burning and telling her everything, there's a terrifying silence on the other end of the line. Might have only been like a second or two. And she says, Hero, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been sober for 22 years. Maybe you need a meeting. And it's something in me just snaps, just breaks, like 2 inches below my belly button. There's like a branch that just goes pop, and I just start sobbing, like stomach crunches, like yucka, yucka, like snot, you know, ugly cry, full body release kind of crying. And I'm crying like this because of, well, for a multitude of reasons. It's so many things were involved here, multi-causal. Like one is just terror, because I know what one day at a time means. It means forever. But also, I'm also bewildered, because she's the one who taught me how to send you to Alcoholics Anonymous. She's the one who taught me to tell you things like, you might not drink right. You might need this place called Alcoholics Anonymous. They know how to stay sober there. I can't help you with that. She taught me to tell you, if you go to Alcoholics Anonymous, go there to identify, not compare. Go there to listen for similarities, not differences. In fact, the next day when I got my sponsor at this place called the Round Table, and then a few weeks later when we were at his kitchen table and we're going through the big book, and we just get to the second page of sentences, and at the end of the preface of the fourth edition, it says, if you have a drinking problem, and by this time I had been taught that if I see the word you or we in the big book, I put in my name or I or me, because when I read the word you or we, I think it means you and not me. So if Hero has a drinking problem, we hope that Hero may pause in reading one of the 42 personal stories. And my sponsor told me, hey, this is telling you how to be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyone who's telling their personal story like I am now, try and pause and think one of these three things. First, either yes, that happened to me, or second, yes, not like that, but most important, yes, I believe this program can work for me too. She taught me to tell you, you might hear about God, and if you don't believe in God, you have trouble with God, you don't like God, don't worry about that. That's Advanced Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a later step. And I knew what to do. I came in here, and I found a sponsor at that very first meeting I went to at the Round Table. And the Round Table in Long Beach, I had no idea, it was the closest one that I could walk to. And the Round Table in Long Beach is known around town as a first step hall, like a really rowdy, really exciting. Most of the people who get up the podium are doing like, you know, 5 to 20 mother effers a minute kind of shares, you know, just thrilling. You never know if it's an AA meeting or like a weird story meeting or a Narcotics Anonymous meeting or what's happening. But eventually somebody gets to the podium and talks about alcohol and alcoholism. And one of the biggest questions whenever people take birthdays is like, why'd you do it? Why'd you do it? We want to know that you drank. And we want to know how amazing it was and also how awful it was. And how you couldn't quit. And you couldn't stay quit. You couldn't stop starting again. And that your condition is absolutely hopeless. Absolutely hopeless. Now, hopelessness is something that the big book tells me I need to generate into in the new person. And that would be abjectly cruel if we didn't have the 12 steps. It's outside of places where they don't have the 12 steps, outside of rooms like this one. Hopelessness is a cardinal symptom of major depressive disorder, right? And major depressive disorder has that viewpoint, has that thinking style that I'm really good at, like a pervasive negative view of self, world, and future. Like, I suck, you and the world sucks, and we're all gonna suck forever. So it's a very seductive point of view. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, hopelessness is a prerequisite. It's only if I'm completely hopeless that I'm going to walk up to somebody I don't even know. And even if I'm brave enough to do that, then I'm going to call them. And even if I'm brave enough to do that, I'm going to listen to their directions and follow them. Now, the big book describes me exactly why I did that. I didn't know it at the time. I hadn't even read the big book yet, but it told me exactly why I did that. I had already come to believe. Coming to believe is in step two, but it's actually before step one. Coming to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as I had been living it. Me, with all of my education, me, with my intellect. Now, one of my teachers, like postmortem, that was the guy who created Gestalt therapy, Fritz Perls. And Fritz Perls used to say that the intellect is the whore of the intelligence. Oh, I identify with this idea. Because my great ideas, sell my soul, make me feel really dirty and unredeemable. But that's the price of entry, that hopelessness. Hopelessness. If you're feeling any amount of hopelessness, I hope you hang on to it. I hope you hang on to your hopelessness. That's your step one experience at however many years so. That's your step one experience. That's the thing that makes you realize, oh my God, I have to pick up the phone. Oh my God, there's someone in the room who's suffering. I got to go talk to them. Oh my God, there's chairs to put away. There's chairs to set up. There's people to call. There's picnics to go to. There's H&I to do. All this stuff, all the ways that my dear friend Larry T talks about. He says, welcome to the newcomer. Welcome to being divinely inconvenienced for the rest of your life. And I'm so grateful to be divinely inconvenienced. And that hopelessness is golden because I hate it. I freaking can't stand it. It's one of the most devastating things to me when I'm working with a new person, they're completely hopeless. And the hopelessness, they start to get hope, but not in the right way. They start the right way is this: hope that doing what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous can give you a life that is worth living, a life of usefulness and joy and connection and helpfulness and responsibility for the welfare of others. What I hate is hope in those other things, like, oh yeah, I'm gonna go back to school, so I'm gonna cut down on my AA meetings to maybe just one. Maybe I'm just gonna zoom in now. Or hope in that relationship, or hope in that job. I'm gonna start working 75 hours a week because I really need to level up and I need to pay off my debts. Or hope in you've seen the four cars on my lawn. I need to fix at least one of them. You know, whatever the hope is, and the hope in that becomes greater than the hope here, and the hope here fades, and the hopelessness fades, and next thing I know, they're experiencing hopelessness once again, and many of them can't come back. I was telling a friend earlier before the meeting, and I have this prayer for the folks that are out right now, and also the ones that are coming in and going out and not fully in. And the prayer is really, really simple. It might be, I'm not an Al-Anon yet, but it might be a beautiful Al-Anon prayer, which is, God, let me love this person until one of us is dead. Because sometimes that's all I can do. Sometimes that's all I can do. The thing about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's to help you have a spiritual experience. And if that word bothers you, or if it makes you think it's all like New Age, my dear friend Kathy E., she was 15 years sober when I came in, so she's still sober today, so she's 32 now. And I remember her saying that her first sponsor, Irma, said, would give her a dollar and say, if I give you a dollar, that's material. One alcoholic talking to another, that's spiritual. And I get that. Something emerges in a room like this. Something emerges when one alcoholic talks to another and talks about alcoholism. And something emerges that is more than the sum of its parts. New physicists call that as an emergent property. Something emerges out of these finite things that seems potentially infinite. And in fact, when I came in here, I was a proud agnostic. I thought it was a scientific stance to just not know. Thank you. And just not know, and to have to perform experiments. And maybe actually, if you're an agnostic, that you do not know whether God is or is. You do not know if there was life before this life or life after this life. If you don't, you do not know if there's an eternal soul, that's okay. I invite you to perform an experiment. If you're done experimenting with before, if you indeed have come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as you had been living it, try our experiment. Try it. And in fact, if you go out, don't worry if you're able to come back in. Come back in and stay, because you've then just performed a really classical single subject experimental design. Like I teach this in experimental methods, or I used to anyway when I taught. And a single subject experimental design is A, B, A, B. So life didn't work, try AA. We're doing A now. We're going to do A. I don't think this is for me. You go out, go back and do it. Go back and do B. See what it's like. If you're able to, and some are not, come back and do AA once more. Hopefully you won't have to figure out B. Now, to be fair, a good experimental design where you're a control and experimental group being AA, you would do it A, B, A, B. Please don't do B again. It doesn't matter if it's a sound experimental design, as long as it's good enough for you. As long as it's good enough for you. And it's crazy. People talk about how so many people go out on the fourth step or in the middle of the ninth step. And there's no bad news in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no bad news. My late grand sponsor, Mark Houston, would talk about the fourth step like this. He would talk about how if you tell a kid, go clean your room, they don't want to do it. They'll do it slowly and they'll do it badly. But if you tell a kid, hey, get everything that's broken, everything that you're tired of, everything that there's a new version of, and fill up these bags with it. And as soon as you're done, we're going to go to the store and get you all new, well, I guess now it'll be, we're going to go online and get you all new toys. That kid is going to be like, fill up those bags and be right there with you. I'm ready. And that was my experience. 1 week, a thorough first inventory. And within 72 hours at my sponsor's kitchen table. And he asked me that hell question, the question that you know you're going to get, but you're hoping maybe he'll forget. And then he asked, is there anything else? Is there anything else that you're going to take to your grave that will kill you and cause you to drink if you don't get free of it now? Because I had those three things. I told him those three things I was never going to tell him. And he gives me the AA cure. He's like, is that it? Yeah, me too, buddy. And he sends me home to finish that fifth step, which is to go home and take a quiet hour. And I make the mistake of calling my friend, Mr. Tom. Mr. Tom, I met on day 7. Mr. Tom was someone I would call up, like tell me about your experience of God, Mr. Tom. Tell me about your higher power. And he would have me do really wacky things. At the time, this is when surveillance on UPS trucks wasn't as intense as it is now. But he'd be driving his UPS truck, and I'd call him up and be like, all right, on the count of three, I'm here in Thousand Oaks. You're down there on Wilshire, and we're gonna open our windows. He didn't have a window, and we're gonna yell out the window, I'm Mr. Tom. I don't know what's gonna happen. And he's like, all right, you're going to take a big hit of God, you know? And we're basically hyperventilating like we were when we were kids, you know. And we're having this amazing time. He's like, you feel that? That's God. I thought it was anoxia. But anyway, so um, But we were having a good time, and he was showing me all these kind of different manifestations of God. In fact, I experienced something like that on day 5 of my sobriety, and before that, I was coming up with solutions like, I'm gonna, you know, I was smoking at the time, I'm gonna just put this out of my arm, like the patients I help who have a diagnosis of a borderline personality disorder, and because they tell me self-injury makes all the pain go away, and I put a cigarette out of my arm, and I'm like, and for a moment, they were right, and for a moment, everything goes white. And then a millisecond later, because I'm a whiny baby man with really low pain tolerance, a moment later, I'm like, oh no, that really hurts. And oh, it's put out, but it still feels like it's burning. This is really bad. And I ended up calling my sponsor in that state. He's like, what's up? I just put down a cigarette in my arm. He's like, huh, you might want to call before you do that next time. And they had me meet him at the meeting. And so I had a couple days like this one where I try solutions at RNAA that just made me feel even worse. But that Friday, I find myself laughing in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's not the kind of laughter like about like internal stimuli that terrifies my family. And it's not laughter at somebody else's expense, like, ha-ha! But instead, I'm laughing at something that the speaker just said that they really shouldn't have shared about. But I'm just laughing. And it's kind of like when back in Tuscaloosa, when my mom would take me into that handy dandy store, and there'd be those two mirrors that are facing each other, and I'd be like, oh, there's me, like seeing infinity, like that's my experience of identification, which is magical. And thank you. And it's kind of like when my favorite lead guitarist, like have that solo with a feedback going like, or with for the younger folk with a DJ, just it's like the last time, like the club's about to shut down, they punch the bass up to 11, and all of a sudden the beat drops, and you feel it go all through your skeletal muscular system, and everybody's vibing together, and we're all it's like in the meeting we're tripping balls, and after we pray out, I go running after my sponsor, and I'm going, what the hell was that? That was amazing. And he says, that was God, buddy. And I'm like, what the. Wait, real? That was God? He's like, yeah, buddy. I want more of that God. Because I'm a peak experience guy. I wish I could have that God all the time, but that's not the way I experience God most of the time. The way I experience God most of the time is devastating, effed up stuff happens, and I don't get drunk. And I'm able to be a little, I'm able to find comfort in severe discomfort. I'm able to accept that I'm not accepting a damn thing. I'm finding everything unacceptable, especially me. And yet I could accept that for the moment and breathe and not drink and call someone else like. That's one of my favorite times to call a 94-year-old and whine to him. I got a friend who's in severe, severe pain that the VA doctors can't figure out. I called him up today to whine to him, and that was rad. Got another friend who may die of pancreatic cancer, and I'm gonna call him up tomorrow and whine to him, and that'll be rad. And it always cheers them up, especially because I do it in a little whiny baby voice because I love doing that voice. But anyway, so I call up my friend Mr. Tom after doing sharing my fifth step, but before I take the quiet hour, and he's like, Mr. Hero, did you get rocketed into the fourth dimension? I was like, F you, no. And I would discover like some folks that I wouldn't actually start to discover this fourth dimension until I start making amends in the ninth step. And there's no bad news in the ninth step. It doesn't matter if they yell at you. It doesn't matter if they won't take it. It doesn't matter if they won't meet with you. What matters is that in your heart, you are amending your heart, you're amending your mind, you're amending your behavior and making yourself available for atonement, at-one-ment. And if you can't with them, at least you will be with you. And my experience is that I'm someone who, on my own power, runs away from grief, and there's a lot of things to grieve about. There's a lot of things, and there's a lot of people to grieve. And it turns out there's one sure way that I can avoid grief, and that one sure way is to avoid love. I know because I've tried it. I know because I've done it my entire life. That where I don't date the person I really want to date, or I break up. I lied. I act in ways that force people to break up with me, so I can be like, oh, I was broken up with. And or I quit school, or I quit jobs before I could discover I can fail. And what you've shown me is all I have to do is not drink and show up and try to be useful with just devastating abyss-like, like what Nietzsche said, staring into the abyss and the abyss staring back. The thing is, stop staring at it, talk to somebody else who's got the abyss, and somehow the abyss is light. What I know today is that if you're new, one of the promises in the big book, one of the 12-step promises is bizarre. It says you're uniquely qualified. Now, I've been a copy editor. I'm not an everyday copy editor. I won't check your grammar unless you pay me. But the word unique, and I know it's common parlance to say, you know, it's very unique, but from a copy editing standpoint, that doesn't exist. Unique means one and only, which means you may be the one and only person who can help another person. In fact, if you go out, if you do not stay, if you do not take these 12 steps and stay, there may be somebody that nobody else in this room or in Alcoholics can reach, Alcoholics Anonymous can reach, except for you. Except for you. So I hope you stay. I hope you stay and learn why I believe we're like a family of vampires. Not that we're going to drain you of blood, but rather we're going to watch the life come, watch you come to life. That's one of the greatest joys. And I love getting high on newcomers. I love getting high on sponsees. I get high on you all. And it's not like I like roll them up and smoke them or like, you know, burn them, like boil them in cotton and like shoot them. But rather seeing the light turn on and laughing hard, like deep from the belly, because we're not dead, because we're not drinking, because we're living a good life and we're helping people. Thank you.